Well, this is the third out of four meetings that we're going to spend talking together, looking at what some of the Buddha's teachings are on the nature of self, or in this particular approach to things, the nature of not self. Because one of the things that most dramatically distinguishes the teachings of the Buddha from the other great wisdom traditions has to do with this very notion of what it means to be a person. What is the nature of mind? You know, the great distinction between his teachings and the Brahmanism of the time. Brahmanism at the time was actually a good deal like the other theistic traditions today, you know, which is to say there is an omniscient, omnipotent God, and then there was the notion of the eternal soul, you know, a being that's in the Brahmanistic or Hindu understanding, a soul that transmigrates across many lifetimes and takes different bodies in its path toward purification. Buddha was quite an empiricist. He since spent about 6 years trying out different practices and studying different doctrines. And as a result of that, he came to radically different conclusions than what was being taught at the time. He taught that what we think of as a permanent and abiding self is actually something of a fiction. It's something that the mind makes up on a moment-to-moment basis. And in fact, it is that moment-to-moment construence of a sense of self that is an important source of suffering. Okay. And so what I want to do this evening, and we've covered some of these issues before, I want to do a little bit of review of what we've covered before. And you know, we had an overview session, and then last time we got together, talked about sort of the five primary ingredients that goes into the recipe for self, right? And what the Buddha called the five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay. And again, I want to reiterate, you know, the Buddha didn't say, well, you think it's like this, but it's actually like this. What he said was, in his teachings about not-self or anatta, he said, please come, abide contemplating the possibility that this is so. And if you find it useful to reflect on these teachings in relationship to your own study of your own mind and the way you think and the way you behave, then you might find these teachings useful, insofar as bringing certain kinds of suffering to an end in your own life. So, as we've covered, you know, these five main ingredients are the body, right? Nama rupa, the consciousness that resides in the mind that is capable of understanding the import of sensory inputs, and of judging them to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, vedana, of identifying or being able to perceive what those things are, perception, and of what are sometimes called the mental factors or the sankharas. And what that is the sum total of all of our life experiences and our emotions and our memories and whatnot that inform how we are in the moment. Okay, that's the five ingredients, but the Buddha described that which we think of as self as the five aggregates affected by clinging, the special secret sauce in the me burger, right? The thing that kind of glues it all together. So this evening what we're going to do is to take that model and then expand on it. Okay, so if you think about, like, if you had these ingredients, you know, you could put them together in one way. You know, let's say if you had some noodles and you had some shrimp and you had, you know, coconut milk and other things, you could take it one direction and you make it curry, or you could leave out the coconut milk and take it another direction and make pad thai or something, right? So there are different directions, different ways you can put these ingredients together, okay? So we're going to be kind of looking at the cookbook. You know, first we've got the list of ingredients, and now we're going to talk about how the mind puts them together to create a sense of self. And this is touching upon this sort of vast and sort of complicated teaching, actually, called dependent origination. Okay. And it basically means that everything co-creates everything else. Okay. And that everything in the universe is always arising and changing and passing away. And I know probably less than nothing about subatomic physics, except what people have told me about how the world works at that level, which is to say, that's kind of how it is, right? There's matter, and matter is always coming together in certain ways and is creating certain things, like the floor and the chairs we're sitting on, and the lighting system and whatnot, and the trees outside. And then after a while, they decay and they fall apart and the molecules get liberated and then they turn into something else, right? So everything in the universe, everything in our experience, everything in our environment is always continuously arising and changing and passing away. Okay. We don't seem to have much of a problem with that until it comes to us. Which tends to be, you know, a little disquieting. Well, that's not moi, you know, me too. You know. Well, yes, says the Buddha, us too. You know, we arise and change and pass away just like everything else. And so, yeah, well, okay, well, maybe that happens over the course of a lifetime. Well, the Buddha says, not really. It happens continuously. That which we think of or like to think of is this self that lasts over the course of a lifetime and sometimes does skillful things and sometimes does unskillful things. Sometimes it's nice and sometimes it's rotten. But still, it's still me, right? Start to finish. Well, no. The idea here is that we are conjuring ourselves on an almost continuous basis. That the mind is constantly pulling these ingredients together in certain ways because of certain causes and conditions and creating self on a moment-to-moment basis. Okay. So that which we think of as self is actually something that the mind fabricates on an ongoing basis. And a lot of you I know have heard me use this simile in the past, you know, after in the movie The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy returns out from her quest with the witch's broom and her friends, and they go to once again into the great hall to meet the great and powerful Oz. And she says, well, you know, I did what you asked, and here's the broom. And he says, well, I can't see you now, come back Monday or whatever. And she gets really mad, and she says, you know, and it's the big green giant head right there in the middle of the hall. And says, I did what you asked, now, you know, take us back home again. And he said, I can't deal with it right now, go away, you know, get out of my face, basically. And then right around that time, of course, is when her little dog pulls the curtain back, and they can see that it's just this little guy running a control panel. Okay. And they run over, and she says, you know, this is terrible, you tricked us, you're really... You know, you're a very bad man. And what does he say in response? He says, oh no, I'm really a very good man. I'm just a really bad wizard. You know? So the self is kind of like that. It's just a really bad wizard, you know? What is a hologram made of? Well, when they were making that movie, what they did was they took, they shot some footage of that face, this man making these pronouncements and whatnot, and then instead of projecting it on a screen, what they did is project it on some green smoke. Okay. So you had the image, and you had that which was projected upon, and you had the soundtrack, and it created the illusion of the big green giant head. The Buddha was asked one time, he said, is there a self or not? You know, someone was demanding a binary answer, you know. And he said, the self cannot be said to exist, nor can the self be said to not exist. Basically, it's there when it's there, and it's not there when it's not there. It's a real hologram, right? So when the projector's running and when the green smoke is going up and when you got the soundtrack going, you get the big green giant head. Okay. And when those one or more of those things is not there, no big green giant head. Okay. No self. And so what the Buddha taught was this process by which we bring this hologram of the self into being. And why? And then he spoke of the means by which we can learn how to not do that. Right? So there are all these other processes that go on in this process of dependent origination, you know, the arising of all these causes and conditions that bring the self into being on a moment-to-moment basis. But rather than march us all through them, what I would rather do is to tell a story, use a kind of an allegory, and kind of fold in some of these ingredients, some of these processes along the way. And then after I've done that, we can have a talk about, you know, our understanding of that and how, a little bit maybe, how to apply it to daily life. So let's assume that you just went off and you did your first week-long silent meditation retreat. And it was really tough, but you found it once you've come back home again, to have been enormously rewarding. That you feel calmer and more at peace than you have perhaps ever before in your life, that you feel like you understand yourself better, you see things more clearly, that you have gained some insight into some of the ways that you cause suffering for yourself and others, how to bring it to an end. You feel some self-compassion. Okay. You feel some equanimity. So you feel enormously grateful for the experience and also really happy to be back home again in a really neutral, peaceful place. And so you're just sitting meditating on the couch, right? And then your tummy grumbles a little bit and you notice that there is the arising of your appetite. So you go into the kitchen, and lo and behold, the cupboard is bare because you've been gone a long time. There's no food in the house. So you go shopping, okay, just so you can satisfy this basic appetite. And you're reflecting on how the food at the retreat was really good, and it was simple, and it was nourishing, and it was a lot better way to eat than you had been, and you lost some weight on the retreat, and that was pretty cool. And so yeah, you have some issues maybe around food anyway. So you think, all right, well, you know, I am going to start clean. I'm going to start living my life just like I was on retreat. And so you go shopping for stuff in the market, you know, that's more or less like what you were eating on retreat. And then you go down the aisle where the desserts are, you know, where the you say, well, you know, there are these really wholesome little, you know, whole wheat fig Newtons on the retreat, and those are pretty good, so I guess I'll get some of those. Because, you know, I really, you know, these books I've been reading on self-compassion and radical acceptance, they all say how important it is to do nice things for yourself, to really reward yourself whenever you can, every chance. So you go down the aisle, and you see the whole wheat fig Newtons. And then over on the other side of the aisle is the freezer case. Okay. And in the freezer case is the ice cream. You look over at the whole wheat fig Newtons, and you think, you know, I didn't really like those that much. It's just all they feed us, you know. And then you look over in the freezer case again, and lo and behold, Ben and Jerry's fish food. Whoa! Rocky Road, mint chip. And what has happened then is sense contact. The eye sees this object. This object recognizes what it is. Okay, there's the contact, the senses, and you feel very pleasant sensations. Why do you feel pleasant, Vedana? Okay, so your immediate response to seeing that carton is a pleasing one. Why? Well, because you've immediately started poking around your memory banks and the sankharas, right? And you say, oh yeah, I remember last time I had that. It was really good, you know? And so there's arising out of this, the sense contact, the memories and whatnot, and your body functioning as it is, there arises craving. I'd really like to have some of that, you know. What kinder thing could I do for myself here in this grocery aisle than get myself just a little carton of Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Okay, so you do that, right? So, and so it makes you feel happy, and then you say, well, you know, I really like fish food, but well, that mint chip, that's really good too. So if I really want to be kind to myself, I should have some choices here, right? So you get a carton of that as well. And you put that in your cart. So the craving, you've seized upon that which you crave. So you've got the clinging, right? Put it in your cart. You're already feeling happy because of the very fact you've got this stuff, even though you hadn't eaten any of it yet at all. Take everything home, and then you sit down and you say, well, you know, I went and got this wonderful food, but I know that if I'm gonna be kind to myself, I can't overdo it. So I'll just put a little fish food in here and I'll have some of that, and that's gonna be it. So you do that and you eat it, and then you think, wow, I really should have had the mint chip. You know, what's the kindest thing I could do for myself right now? Well, maybe I'll go back and have a little bit of the mint chip, you know. So you get some of that, and you say, well, you know, what I really remember is how good they tasted together. So then you go back, and you get a little bit of both of them, and you start eating those, and then all of a sudden you realize, well, one's running out faster than the other one, so I better go back and even it out again, right? And the first thing you know, you've eaten almost a quart of ice cream. Okay. So you've got the sense contact, the craving, the clinging, the what's called the being and becoming. You know, you ingest the ice cream, all right? And now you have become this person that has ingested almost a quart of ice cream. Okay. So we went from the craving and clinging person to the person that's eating the ice cream. Who are you now? What you have done now is to create a remorseful person. Because you look back and you think about having sat on that couch just 2 hours earlier, feeling peace and equanimity and open-heartedness and self-acceptance, right? And you realize that person is gone. You killed him off with a quart of Ben & Jerry's. And now you've given birth to a remorseful person who feels terrible about themselves and is saying, what a waste. I go away on this retreat and come back thinking I've got it together, and it was for nothing. You know, I'm as bad off as I was before I went. Not only that, I feel even worse about myself than if I hadn't even gone. You know, so then you spend some time just feeling really crappy about yourself. You've given birth to a remorseful person. Here, when you first got home, you were feeling so positive and open-hearted about yourself, right? Given rise to that. Now you're feeling terrible about yourself. Sitting there feeling terrible about yourself, thinking, this is suffering. Suffering that arose out of craving and clinging. Okay. I think they said something about that on the retreat. Okay. Feeling self-aversion because I succumbed to craving and clinging. And noting that it is that very self-aversion that is causing you to suffer, and it's a creation of your own mind. And having realized that you've done that, and having realized something else they said on the retreat about suffering being the gateway to compassion, you realize that self-aversion is a form of suffering, and it comes from your inability to forgive yourself for having succumbed to craving and clinging. And so then out of that can arise some compassion for this whole set of processes you went through over this last 2 hours. Coming home feeling really good about yourself as the person who is open-hearted and self-accepting, then gravitating, you know, with the sense contact and the craving and the clinging and all the other stuff that's going on. And there, of course, were other things going on as well, all right? When you were looking at the ice cream in the cabinet, and you were thinking, oh, this is just the kindest possible thing I could do for myself. There was another factor at work back then, and what the way it's referred to in the classic text is ignorance, right? Except not ignorance in terms of a simple lack of information, but ignorance in the form of ignorance, seeking to ignore, actively choosing only at a subconscious level not to observe certain things, like your own history with Ben and Jerry's, right? But I've never been able to stop after a half cup. Once I get going, I'm off to the races. Somehow or another, I conveniently forgot that, right? So coming from that place of ignorance, I exercise the volition to get the ice cream instead of those nasty whole wheat fingers, right? Aha, ignorance, volition, all these things at work that got me to where I am. So at any rate, now, by virtue of the fact you've just been on this retreat where they tell you all about dependent origination, you can sit there and reflect on the ways that the mind chose not to see how, you know, what really would be the kindest thing you could do for yourself. What would have been the wisest thing you could have done for yourself there, but didn't, right? So, ignorance, volitions, you know, nama rupa, the body, the senses, the sense contact, the seeing what it is, the going into the memory banks. When you're prowling around in the sankharas there, your memories of eating Ben and Jerry's, you conveniently remembered the times that it just tasted so good that it was the best things in the world. You conveniently forgot the times you pigged out, right? And the unfortunate consequences that that had for you. So reflecting back on all that, you can kind of see, you can point out, you know, when I was making these choices, what was there ignorance at work? Was there ignoring? Was there choosing not to see? Was there choosing not to remember certain things about my own history with food that played a role in my making the decision that I did? Okay. That played a role in me making unskillful decisions going forward. And it's from being able to watch that entire sequence of, you know, the creation of these multiple selves. You know, back in the old days when you used to make movies, they still call it film, but, you know, they used to make movies with film. And what the mechanism was they were taking these individual still photographs, right? 24 frames per second. That's the rate at which they need to move in order to create the illusion of continuous motion, right? And so that's one useful way to think about the creation of self. We do it rapidly, we do it sequentially all the time, and we thereby create this illusion of consistency, of sameness, when in fact the mind was conjuring all these selves, one right after another, after another, after another, until that realization came, that moment came of insight. It's why we call it insight meditation. When you're able to look back at this very rapidly occurring sequence of mental processes that gave rise to the conjuring of self. And once we get a little bit of insight into how that mechanism works, we can start picking out the places where we can chop it up, where we can really interrupt the process of self-creation. Identify that place, for instance, where ignorance and volition came together, right? You know, there's that saying, whether a pickpocket is in a crowded with bazaar with other shoppers or a holy temple with other worshipers, he still sees only pockets. You know, it's this relationship between motivation and perception. That if you see something and the craving sets in, what the craving does is block out the ability of the mind to remember everything about your history with Ben and Jerry's. And you only remember how good it tasted rather than the other. That's the model. Enid, you have a question?
How do you interrupt the cycle, if it's considered a cycle, so that you don't, you might reach for it, but then you don't take it?
Thank you. Really good question. One of the things that we do in this practice is it's called the noting practice, noting, giving a label to whatever it is we see coming up in the mind. And so when you see craving arise, just labeling it as craving, like staying in the aisle looking for Ben and Jerry's, okay, one of the things you know from experience is that craving blocks out the ability to see clearly. The craving for the Ben and Jerry's blocks out your ability to remember your history with Ben and Jerry's. So when you can note the arising of craving, what you already are aware of is that the function of the craving is to block out things you don't want to see and only focus on the ones that you do. And if you can see that going on, and anybody who has had to work with craving over there for whatever, you know, over the course of their lives probably recognizes this model. You know, that one of the things that to do is to recognize when the craving arises, because you know that when it does, one of its functions is to cloud judgment. So there's that. I've been talking so far just about, you know, using a simple model of craving things, you know, just the gratification of sense desires. Okay. But craving, in the way the Buddha talked about it, has to do with wanting things to be different than they are. So it may be wanting to gratify the senses, you know, something attractive. It may be really, really not wanting things to be as they are. Okay. So things that we really don't want to have happening in our lives happen anyway. Okay. The loss of a loved one, the end of a relationship, you know, a loved one who is near death, okay. Getting some bad medical news, you know, or dealing with, you know, physical ailments, things of this nature, right? That we really wish weren't happening, but they're happening anyway. Okay. That's one of the reasons the Buddha taught those five daily recollections, you know. I am of a nature to age. I've not gotten beyond aging. I'm subject to illness and infirmity. I have not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. I am of a nature to die. I have not gotten beyond death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. By that he meant whatever we do in this moment creates who we are in the next moment. You know, my actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I will become the heir. So what he's saying is, if we can wake up and remember that these things are true and put these, you know, those remembrances together with this model, this notion that we're literally making ourselves up as we go along, then we can begin to awaken to the need to, when we see, you know, really powerfully aversive states of mind or powerfully grasping states of mind or deluded states of mind arising, to not act based on those states of mind. And then when we see a state of mind imbued with generosity or with open-heartedness or with wisdom, that those are the states of mind that are a reliable basis for action. So basically it's using this model as a way of reflecting on how the mind works so we can begin to increase our odds of doing less harm and more good going forward, whether to ourselves or others. Thank you. Please, your questions, yes.
Well, I was gonna speak to your question in that discussion. My own experience, one, you need to have that witness consciousness to be able to see that arising. But I find my ability to actually make a change on something that I've been habitual about is subject to my ability to just be with the discomfort.
Yes.
And even though emotionally I don't want to do that.
Thank you. To be with the unpleasant without aversion and the pleasant without clinging.
Yeah, and just experience all the body sensations mm-hmm. and the feelings and not, you know, want to take a drink, watch TV, you know, all the, yeah.
It's the working definition of equanimity, right? Being able to be with the unpleasant without aversion and the pleasant without attachment. You know, pleasant, unpleasant, they arise. They change, they pass away. It's how we relate to them that makes all the difference. Thanks, Luke.
And the last thing is I find, it, and I don't claim to be an expert on this, but I find if I practice with the not so big things, when a little bit bigger things come, I'm better able to work with it. Mm-hmm. Even not the other way.
Yeah, good, thanks. Appreciate it. Please, yes.
So I love ice cream. So can't I enjoy it without the guilt and the suffering? That's my question. I mean,
it really has to do with your relationship to it. Uh-huh. You know, if you can enjoy a little of it, period, fine. Revel in it, you know. The Buddha or the Dalai Lama said once, you know, we seek pleasure as a substitute for happiness. Yeah. If you can have a taste of your favorite ice cream, you know, and keep it to a half a cup or so, great. And then put the rest away. It's when you say, well, that made me a little happy. Maybe if I eat more, I'd be even happier, right? Okay. That's where the craving kicks in and the clinging. And then it's no longer about nourishing yourself. It's no longer about nourishing the body at any weight. You know, it's heading into that zone that the Dalai Lama just talked about. You know, seeking pleasure as a substitute for happiness, you know. And that's a lot of what, you know, eating issues come from. You know, trying to find some way to make ourselves feel better, okay? And other forms of addiction as well oftentimes have that at their root, yeah.
But what about more extreme forms of this, and I don't know if it's more extreme, like alcoholism, drug addiction, mm-hmm. sexual addiction, whatever. I mean, this sounds like, I don't know, sometimes it feels like it might be a panacea to not do those things when you might need a lot more help than just your practice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For people that have been working with these issues for a long time, we know that they're multifaceted, that they come from many directions. There can be just the sheer physical dependency, okay? But then there can also be what the motive was to head in the direction of that dependency in the first place.
Typically a childhood wound, say.
It's usually some effort at self-help of trying to help make yourself feel better, to protect yourself in some way. People that eat a lot, sometimes it's literally that, just, you know, wanting to protect themselves from that which they may have suffered in the past. And then, of course, once the addictive properties kick in, you know, it's like drinking seawater to quench your thirst. And so, yeah, there is a 12-step group, or people who belong to various 12-step groups around the Denver area, but who were also Buddhists and wanted to, you know, sometimes some of the meetings they were going to got a little heavy into the theism, and they wanted to a place where they could kind of translate those teachings into the Dharma. And we were talking one night about this notion of emptiness, voidness of self and whatnot. And he said, well, you know, that's all very good, but at 3 o'clock in the morning, when every cell in my body is crying out for a drink, emptiness doesn't quite get it. And so we talked then about the cultivation of the Brahma-Viharas, the cultivation of self-compassion, the cultivation of selfless joy, the cultivation of equanimity, being able to be, you know, with the unpleasant without aversion. Yes, this is addiction. Yes, this is craving. Yes, I'm sitting with it. Yes, I'm going to have a cup of Cafix or something. I'm just not going to drink. Self-care. You know, there's a lot in Buddha Dharma about self-care, cultivation of these qualities. So what teaching is appropriate for what circumstance? You know, the image on the altar this evening is Guanyin, which the bodhisattva of compassion in Chinese Buddhism. And the reason that I have her up here tonight is because these teachings on not-self ain't for sissies. this is can be kind of a shock to the system, you know, to begin to contemplate the possibility that there's nobody home, that we are just this rapidly occurring sequence of mental processes. But nonetheless, within that whole schema, there are choice points, you know, especially when we recognize the arriving of craving, which is, you know, basically just the arriving of a strong desire for things to be different than they are. And we know that when craving arises, it clouds judgment. It makes it not possible to see clearly. And so to be able to sit back and observe the craving, desire for things to be different than they are, you know, and be with that, understanding what it is, then we don't inflict what the Buddha called a second dart. We can experience the sorrow. We can experience the grief, we can experience the depression, we can experience whatever it is we're experiencing without also putting a whole lot of energy into wishing it weren't happening, you know. Accepting things as they are is not the same as approving of things as they are, okay? It's simply saying, this is how it is now. It is what it is. Okay. How can I be with this in a skillful way? That's why we call it practice. It's an art form. It's something that you gotta do on a pretty continuous and a pretty regular basis. You don't just kind of learn it like learn how to ride a bike and that's it. It's an ongoing activity that is crucial to our freedom. Otherwise, it's so easy to just fall back into the habit or the view of permanent and abiding self. Well, I'd like to change, but I really can't. If you have this notion, you know, that you're kind of locked in and that you are as you are, an end of story, okay? It's like a self-created prison, and that's the way the Buddha described it. He said, if you want to become free of these afflictions, then you have to start thinking about the nature of self and not self and the nature of mind in a different way. And when you can do that, when you can adopt this more fluid, open-ended way of thinking about who we are at any given point in time, that it really does allow more freedom in terms of how we live our lives going forward.
There's a really wonderful formulation of this that comes from Upandita Sayadaw. He said, the self arises wherever there is clinging.
Mm-hmm.
The self arises wherever there is clinging.
So I find that really interesting because it seems like whenever there is clinging, everything stops. You know, if we're talking about non-self, then everything flows. Mm-hmm. But as soon as we grab onto something, there's your solid self, and there is no sense of flow.
Yeah, we kind of lock in.
Yeah.
Become that thing, right? Sokni Rinpoche, the Dzogchen teacher in the Tibetan tradition, sort of analogizes our states of consciousness to ice, water, and air. You know, he says, when we're deeply contracted around and clinging to a sense of self, it's like we're ice. When we've let go of self and things just kind of flow, it's more like we're water. Said most of us who are doing Buddha Dharma practice exist in a state of slush. Somewhere in between, you know. Sometimes we're kind of fluid, and sometimes we're kind of solid, you know. And then when we let go completely, you know, we just become clouds in the sky. Right, it's that sense of flow, yeah.
Well, it's interesting that it's that self itself is a state of suffering. That's, you know.
Yep, it's kind of, in this understanding, it's kind of one of the working definitions.
Yeah.
Comes into being for a reason. And it can be, like, you know, it can be because there is some really strong hunger that suddenly arises that we, you know, kind of gather around. It can be, you know, if we had a lot of trauma or really bad things happen to us in our past, then any stimulus that brings those to mind, we can quickly bring a self together around a need for self-protection, trying to avoid future harm based on past experience. So it can manifest for a variety of reasons, but whenever it does, it's usually, you know, brings along with it a certain amount of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, either strong or mild. Okay, please.
So one of the things we're talking about with the retreat was that the self is a mental construct.
Yes.
And the Buddha talked about how breaking through that mental construct, breaking the ritual or logical or whatever, so it seems like it's and so what you're doing is you're concentrating your mind, and then you're just, what do they call that, the point, the, you know, you're just resting in the concentration, and if your mind wants to go towards a certain point, it might be able to break through that mental construct and see that, you know, like you used to believe in Santa Claus, and after you do that point moment or whatever that phrase was, then you don't, you just blow through that construct.
Yeah.
That mental construct.
It's called the experience of anatta. Right. The knowing of not self, the realization that there's nobody home, basically. Yeah.
So it seems like it's more than just thinking about it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But it's kind of like, you know, like I like to go bird watching, and, you know, so I've had these little field manuals for recognizing birds, and especially if it's one I haven't seen before, and then when I go out in the field, I see one, oh, I kind of know what that is. So the teachings around anatta or a lot of these other concepts actually are like a field guide. It's just so that if you're, you know, in pretty deep samadhi sometime and the mind's really calm and suddenly you realize there's nobody home, you know, that the mind's not construing self, that the heart's still beating, the lungs are still breathing, but that there is nobody, you know, that entity you would think of as yourself is simply not present. And you realize that in a more than just a conceptual way. Yeah, it changes your view a little, yeah.
When you have that, like when I've had a very rare moments of that, yeah. Something like myself all of a sudden recognizes that and I get more respect. So.
Yes.
What is that?
Right. It's essentially when that experience happens, there is just this sense of brightness and openness, and it's as if you're suddenly seeing things very clearly. The Zen master, the founder of Korean Zen, Shinul, talked about as a flash of lightning in a summer cloud. You know, all of a sudden things are very brightly illuminated. And then right after that, for most of us, the discursive mind, you know, kicks in, whoa, what was that? You know, and so it's like you're looking back on having had the experience of not self. You know, you realize it for what it was because you heard a talk about it sometime or other, right? And so at least you've got a name for it and you won't get freaked out and think that maybe you're losing your marbles or something because that just happened. Oh, that's what that was, right? And then if that happened once, if you keep practicing and go on a retreat every now and then, it's gonna happen again, probably. And then that experience starts to become cumulative and it begins to really, really shift your worldview, your understanding of, you know, the nature of mind. Absolutely. Okay, other questions or comments? All right then, well, let's settle in for a moment, do a little bit more sitting. Thus shall we think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. Safe journey home.